And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Architecture and the way our buildings are constructed impact more than your eyes. Research shows that our built environment affects our overall health, too. That idea is the focus of this week's American Institute of Architects Ohio Valley Regional Conference. And today, we're joined by the keynote speakers, Terrapin Bright Green, Director of Projects and Technical Specialist, Katie Ryan. Hi, Katie.
Hi there.
And we also have UCLA Fielding School of Public Health pediatrician and professor emeritus, Dr. Richard Jackson. Hi, Richard.
Good to be with you, Michael. Hi.
And we'd like for you to join us as well. You can call us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So AIA Cincinnati is hosting the AIA Ohio Valley Regional Conference this week, and it's supposed to have the theme Building Wellness, and it will include a focus on how architecture contributes to healthy people, healthy communities, and healthy environments. I'd like to get both of you to weigh in on this, but we'll start with you, Katie. What does that mean exactly?
Well, a lot of the focus of at least in my experience, what I've seen, a lot of the focus of architecture and design is on the visual experience. We tend to forget about that multi-sensory aspect of the environment and how that might impact our psychophysiological well-being. And given, you know, the uptake and awareness in stress and general health, it's like a perfect opportunity to kind of recalibrate and think more holistically about what health and wellness really means and why we design for people and what that really means.
And Richard, you come at this from the medical side of things. Give us your explanation on how you see architecture and the built environment impacting more than just our eyes, but also our overall health and well-being.
You know, over 100 years ago, the most common disease in America that people died of was tuberculosis. The average American lived 30 years shorter than we do today. And back then, when the American Public Health Association started, it was a combination of business leaders, doctors, planners, political leaders. But the big idea was we have to build in ways that help people to be healthier. You didn't need to be a scientist to know that living in a badly ventilated, dark, damp place increased your risk of TB and a whole series of other diseases. And not eating, not getting access to healthy food and good drinking water was a threat. We've added 30 years to the lifespan of Americans by changing the built environment. And I first started to interact with the American Institute of Architects about 20 years ago when I complained that they were too focused on the visual and they didn't realize that one third of their obligations was about the health and well-being of human beings. And they have stepped up in profound ways, and I'd love to talk about it more.
For sure. Richard, what do you see as having changed over the past couple of decades as the builders of our communities see the importance of creating an experience that's more than just taking in the visual sight of whatever's being constructed?
20 years ago, if a green field building was going on, it was often built around a golf course. It catered to a very select population. We built neighborhoods that completely lacked sidewalks. We built buildings where you were penalized if you tried to walk up the stairs. And over that same period of time, we've seen a massive change, degradation in the health of the American people. Chronic diseases are now so prevalent. We're at the point now where 40% of U.S. adults are obese, and a large portion of them are inactive. Being in that kind of situation means your blood pressure is too high, your cholesterol is too high, you have greatly increased risk of stroke, type 2 diabetes, and part of this is we have engineered physical activity out of the environment. The other most prevalent disorder after tooth decay is depression, and one of the causes associated with depression is people have become increasingly isolated. And I would argue that how we have built our homes, our communities, our cities have pushed us towards isolation and have pushed us towards inactivity. And the American Institute of Architects got that message. They've taken it much more seriously.
And Dr. Jackson, you're quoted in an article that I wanted to read part of to our listeners today. It comes from the Project for Public Spaces. It's about how great communities grow at the intersection of health and design. I'm just going to read a segment of this article. It says, it was big news last month when a group of retired U.S. generals published a report highlighting a little-known threat to national security. Our kids are not healthy enough to fight. These are military generals. They say even in Minnesota, where people pride themselves on being handy, two-thirds of young people are too obese or unhealthy to meet the military's fitness requirements. According to a delegation of public health experts meeting with Minnesota citizens during the fourth annual placemaking residency, little exercise and poor diets pose a serious problem, not only on foreign battlefields, but also here at home for people of all ages. The event, which sparked discussion of looming health issues across the Twin Cities, was sponsored by the St. Paul Riverfront Corporation. So you have these community organizations facilitating these conversations that have international consequences, it seems. And I have a quote here from you, Dr. Jackson. This building of America for the benefit of cars is starting to backfire. We should put people first. Can you expand on that for us?
When we built for cars, and just think about it, and your listeners, in the 1950s and 60s and so, over 65% of children walked or biked to school. That's now down to about 15%. And the main reasons for that is we have built with a total focus on moving people by cars, and a lot of your listeners will agree. They may even be doing it right now. The worst traffic jams in many communities are around the schools during pickup and drop-off town. There are many kids that are being driven to school only three or four blocks. And so we're seeing a decline in the fitness of our children and this increase in obesity. There's dramatic increase in the number of young people that can't get into the U.S. military because of obesity. And I'm emphasizing obesity here, but the other part of this is inactivity is bad for us. And, you know, we all probably need to lose weight, but if we can at least increase our activity level, we blunt that negative impact of inactivity. But in my video series, I interviewed six young women who were teenagers in high school. And if they wanted to do anything, they had to ask their mother to drive them somewhere, drive me to the mall, drive me to a friend's house. And so we've circumscribed the lives of our children in profound ways. And we've done the same thing with our elderly, who, if you live in a neighborhood where you can't go anywhere or socialize and you need to have someone pick you up in a car, again, we're isolating people more and more rather than connecting us more and more.
And Katie Ryan is with us also. Katie, we know that the country is suffering various health problems, obesity among children being a common topic of conversation. Are you seeing more concern about this being implemented into design across the country, or is there still some area for growth in that?
There's always room for growth, but I'd say that in addition to obesity and asthma and addressing those health issues, mental health has been a huge focus, and I have been seeing a shift in awareness and action towards that. You're having universities, I think, in particular, are recognizing the mental health of their students and how they're able to perform and function healthy, and that also influenced just even starting much sooner than that. The cognitive development and mental health of children will affect their long-term success. And so there has been a shift, but it's still relatively early, in the way we design schools or we design communities and even just workplaces to at least try to mitigate on-site stressors. Design can't necessarily design out all sources of stress, but it can certainly help support people or mitigate on-site building-related stress. So that's where I'm seeing a lot of the work. But it's also a lot of what I do is try to communicate to various audiences that we're actually, we have, I frame it differently. We are, I'm having to educate on the intuitively obvious, the way we used to design before electric lighting, before air conditioning and so on, used to be a lot healthier. Hygiene aside, but in terms of, like, access to daylight, access to stairs, more natural ventilation in buildings, good views, those types of things can address a number of health issues, stress included.
One of the cool things about being a journalist, if I may, is you get the opportunity to go along for the ride when one of our local communities is going through one of those planning situations and a consultant mm-hmm. comes in and then ultimately the final ideas are presented. And so I've gotten to experience that several times. And one thing that has stuck with me as a downtown resident in the urban core is the idea that was presented that we need to have fewer surface parking lots downtown, for example, because of the way it impacts your mind while you're walking. If you're walking past a parking lot in an urban area, the walk seems longer. It's less enjoyable than when you're on one of the main streets where all the buildings are next to each other and up against the curb. And I've now noticed that this is just offered anecdotally, of course, but that's been my personal experience after having been made aware of that. It's quite noticeable, particularly when you're walking in one of the urban areas where, say, a new apartment building has gone up. It's built close to the curb and it's across from an old surface parking lot. You can definitely feel the difference depending on which side of the street you're on. 513-419-7100 is the number to join our conversation. Let's check out the phones now. We have Ron on the line. Hi, Ron. What's your question or comment? Is Ron on the line? Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead with your question.
Well, I was just wondering if there are any plans in the future as far as development in the city to take into consideration global warming and the fact that the cities often are warmer than outside areas. But to, you know, just take into all this, get the community involved in a mulching kind of program where people can just take their coffee grounds, bring in somewhere, you know, the potted soil, and incorporate Cincinnati, gardens, co-op gardens, people who are just aware of trees, plantings. And I just think if everyone got involved, it could be an incredible educational process, a community process, and a learning process for everybody. Because you get tons of professionals out there who, like me, I'm retired. I'd love to contribute. I was an environmental scientist for 22-plus years. I've been teaching. Well, I actually grade school papers now as far as data, tests and stuff. But there's a hunger for all these issues in science related to water treatment, the environment, trees, and coolness.
Ron, I appreciate the call very much, and we'll let our experts who are on the line with us address that. Thanks so much for the call. We'll hang up and let them answer Katie or Richard. We just did a show not too long ago about what one group of scientists says will happen to Cincinnati if carbon emissions are not more aggressively addressed, climate change issues are not more aggressively addressed. One of the issues was we're going to see a lot more days with the heat index over 90. In fact, we'll have 90 days per year in Cincinnati with that. Is climate change becoming more of a consideration in the design as the thought of incorporating positive health outcomes are considered?
Could I jump in on that
one? Absolutely, Richard.
I spent 10 years essentially as head of environmental health in the United States at CDC, and over time became more and more, frankly, obsessed with the change in our climate. Any of you listeners who are gardeners know that the planting zones that are put out by the Department of Agriculture are moving north. And for example, New York is now as hot as Washington, D.C. was, and Washington as hot as Atlanta. So we're seeing this over and over, too, is at the end of World War II, there was only 300 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're now up to 414 parts per million. And that drives heat. There's no denying that reality. And a couple of things that, and I, it reflects the caller's concern. Things, about a third of all that CO2 increase is due to transportation, burning fossil fuels. Another 20% is due to how we build our buildings. And Katie's point about you can build them in very efficient, smart ways. People knew how to do this 2,000 years ago. And you can, a much better way for people to move around is to be walking or biking and exercising rather than burning fossil fuels sitting in a car. So, and your point about walking, no one wants to walk again, next to a dusty, litter-filled parking lot or vacant lot. We want to be in pleasant environments. And I think in some ways what Katie's saying is we've got to make the easy thing, the pleasant thing, the healthy thing in our lives.
I want to talk to you, Katie, about the idea of what biophilia is. And then, Richard, I want you to share this great story that I read that you wrote about how an early trip to the hospital as a child sort of influenced the trajectory of your own professional career. And we will get into that coming up as we continue our conversation about the impact of our built environment on our overall health, which is going to be the topic of this week's American Institute of Architects Cincinnati chapter hosting the Ohio Valley Region Conference. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The effect of architecture and building materials on the way we feel is the focus of this week's American Institute of Architects Ohio Valley Regional Conference. Let's continue now with the keynote speakers on two different nights this week, Terrapin Bright Green, Director of Projects and Technical Specialist Katie Ryan, and we also have UCLA Fielding School of Public Health pediatrician and Professor Emeritus Dr. Richard Jackson. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Email us at talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Katie, you've written about this concept, I believe I'm saying this correctly, biophilia?
Yes, actually, biophilia has been written about now for quite some time, for decades. But the focus of what I've been writing about and educating people on is biophilic design. So taking the theory of biophilia and applying it to our architecture. Biophilia is the innate connection with nature that humans have. And the biophilic design really takes the theory into practice at looking at how neuroscience and environmental psychology and other areas of science can support our rationale for designing in a way that improves the holistic experience of a space or place. I'll be talking in depth about some of the science on Thursday.
You've also written about some of the patterns of biophilic design, nature in the space, for example, mm-hmm. like a visual connection with nature. Can you help us understand what that might be?
Sure. Well, the idea of this pattern language was to help create a dialogue and bring different disciplines together and be able to have a common language in which they can talk about these. So there are other entities out there who have created their own pattern language, but essentially they all are communicating the same thing, that there are distinct experiences within nature that can be translated into design characteristics or experiences. So this visual connection with nature is often associated with having a good view out your window or just having a connection to plants or animals, things like that. Those are the nature in the space. You're talking about light, water, air quality. And then there's more abstract considerations like patterns and materials that come from nature, a lot of wood surfaces,
textures, stone, textiles, and like how you can incorporate that more into like maybe the interior space rather than the structure itself. And then there's nature of the space, which is really looking at the larger spatial qualities and how they might influence psychology of the space. So whether there's good prospect and how that might inform decision-making or your perception of safety, as well as like the refuge conditions, and how do you find a good balance relative to the particular audience you're designing for. So there's a we're working with 14 or 15 patterns that we have selected based on the amount of research done to date that really supports that those patterns.
And Richard, when we introduce you as a pediatrician and professor emeritus from the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, it may seem strange to listeners. It certainly seems strange to me at first that you would be such an expert on the impact of the built environment on our health. But I read your story that you wrote about Cook Children's Medical Center and how an early trip to the hospital as a child sort of influenced the way that you look at these issues. Would you mind sharing a summarized version of that story for us?
You know, a lot of us grow up traumatized by the health system. My dad, who was 27 years old and had survived as a fighter pilot in the South Pacific, died in 3 days of polio, leaving my mother with three babies. And not long after that, one of my brothers developed tonsillitis, and I ended up having a tonsillectomy as well. That's what they did. All three boys got tonsillectomies, but mine kept bleeding for weeks. And so my first experience in hospitals was one of hardened surfaces, deep loneliness, odd odors and smells. Kids remember smells more than anything. And of course, after that kind of trauma, what do? I become a pediatrician. I think in some ways because I really sympathized and understood what children went through. Early in my training, hospitals were still fairly hardened spaces in the sense that, you know, people that design hospitals, I think, design prisons. But over time, we've seen a real evolution in the awareness. A lot of very hard things happen in hospitals, whether it's the treatment room and bone marrow sampling or other such things. And creating spaces where children can at least feel welcome, that the social needs are met. Many of our children that get transplants now have to be in isolation. And designing rooms, and architects are really important to this, where a child can be in isolation. And yes, the whole family's on the other side of a plate glass window, but the ventilation is done in a way the child's not exposed to a family member or someone else on the other side of that window causing it and causing it or spreading an infection. So one of the things I love about the children's hospital is early in my training, they had cartoon characters everywhere on the walls. It turns out they don't make people happy. Children are, and actually people, adults, are also much happier looking at pictures of nature just as and photographs of nature, as Katie just indicated. One of the things I loved about the Fort Worth Children's Hospital was that the floor tiles on each floor, so you knew where you were. One of the real problems in hospitals is wayfinding. So one floor had all sea creatures embedded in the floor, if you will, or outlines and drawings and plaques of them, and another would have birds, etc. And thinking really through the eyes of the child, thinking through the experience of the person who's ill is very important as we design places where people, frankly, sometimes really have to suffer.
513-419-7100 is the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones now. Angela is on the line. Hi, Angela. What's your question or comment?
Yes, hi. I was wondering, with Katie's work with biophilia, and she talks a little bit about prospect, designing for different kind of social conditions. Some people are introverts, some are extroverts. Some spaces we want to encourage gathering, other places we don't. So how could we use biophilia to create that balance of prospect and refuge or smaller group spaces versus spaces that also might encourage a sense of adventure or more activity in them?
Angela, thanks so much for the call. We'll hang up and give Katie an opportunity to answer. Katie, you heard that question. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, it is a great question. It's one that I hear quite often, and the answer is simply, it all depends. You have to know your audience, but essentially, the idea of prospect and refuge really does apply broadly to any group. What's important is understanding what the needs of the group are and how much control we can actually give them. So having options is really important. Working with a lot of workplace design, you find that, for example, you can't having just one kind of workspace or conference space doesn't meet everybody's needs. So the ability to change the size or change the lighting conditions or the prospect out of the space or into the space. So I've seen any number of solutions for that, from having just multiple different prototypes and different scales for numbers of people or activities, to just having options within the space that allows more control. So the controllability really depends on the culture of the entity for whom you're designing. But I think we jump too quickly as an industry to designing and then trying to figure out how it works afterwards, than to first understand the users and the different experience using a space and what different activities will unfold before trying to identify the solution.
I guess I'm kind of glad that question came in, because the producers and I were very selfishly about to inquire about the impact that open office spaces might have on people. Our station is about to move, or we're in the early stages of building a new building, and we're all going to lose our single office spaces and being lumped together into an open office space. And so I guess some people are a little nervous about that, but that was some reassuring advice. So the AIA Cincinnati chapter will be welcoming the AIA Ohio Valley Regional Conference this week, September 19th through the 21st, right here in Cincinnati. Katie Ryan, the Director of Projects and Technical Specialist at Terrapin Bright Green, is giving Thursday's keynote address, exploring how design can better connect people with nature. And Friday's keynote speaker is Dr. Richard Jackson, a pediatrician and professor emeritus at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. He'll be discussing the impact of design on the quality of life. Katie and Richard have been our guests this afternoon. Thanks to both of you for this great conversation. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.